Today is the day the Lord has made, and I am thankful and glad within it. And these are the times in which God has decided we will live. And these are some times that I often just say, and I kind of feel sad that it's become something that I sometimes just say, that we have unique responsibilities because of the time in which we live. Because of what the nation is now discovering about leftists like Jay Inslee, the so-called governor of Washington State, that can't be anything like a throwaway line. Jay Inslee's decision to force racism into the schools is an unspeakable act of evil. It is an evil policy. Now, I am not saying that Jay Inslee is an evil man. I think that Jay Inslee is simply the apparatchik of all apparatchiks. I don't think he has one care one way or another about actual governance. I think that he understands that he's a man who is caught up in a power web. And his power is connected to how he continues to serve a master that, as Rose McGowan has said, may not be our own. He has people who've elected him. And they have a very similar dynamic. They're not in the power dynamic. They're not in a power web. But they're very much caught up in the idea that their identity, their political identity, is involved and wrapped around this notion of progress. And they're people who don't particularly care about governance. They care about the feeling of governance. It's like people who don't care about nutritious food. They care about the taste of food. Right? It's not a nutrition level thing. That's an actual condition people get. That if you ever, you know, are around circles of anorexics, they have this equation they'll use in their mind. It's taste per calorie, taste intensity per calorie. So they'll have things like really sharp, citrusy flavored, you know, a popsicles is a big one for anorexics because you're getting a bunch of taste, but you're not having a lot of calorie. In the case of critical race theory, which is racism, being inserted into the schools, you have a whole bunch of people who are getting the taste of progress. They're getting to feel like they're fighting racism. But they're not at a point in their life or in their intellectual development where they're willing to really understand that they are involved in the literal scapegoating of a race. This should terrify everybody. The government policy in Washington State in the schools is that white people are the problem with the world. Every time this has ever been done to an ethnic group, it has ended in catastrophe. Catastrophic wars have been fought because this racial group is to blame. And everybody who's ever studied even a hint of European history understands this precisely. And yet that is what Jay Inslee has installed into the Washington State schools by virtue of forcing racism into the schools. It is now the official theory of schools in Washington State that the problem with the world is white people and the problem with white people is they're white. That's not a problem you can eradicate without, well, really extreme acts. If you're a teacher, you need to speak out or you are part of this. Sorry. I have friends who are teachers who have sent me notes about this. I love them. They're terrific people. Well, let me just speak in the first person. You are terrific people, all of you. If you don't speak out now, you're part of this. This is now your policy. And I understand that you don't run your schools. If you don't speak out, this is your policy. You're part of it. If you don't speak out in public, you're part of it. And I understand that could mean the end of your job. And I want you to just reflect on something. This is a quote from George or from Aldous Huxley. Well, what do we switch back and forth between Huxley and Orwell at this time? I describe this as someone who, this is dynamic, Jay Inslee, is caught up in a power web. He knows he has no hope of being president. He's applied his Peter principle and then some, pretending to be governor of Washington State. Jay Inslee is self-aware enough to understand that he has not a shot, at anything other than maybe going into the Senate to go replace Maria Cantwell if she gives him permission to run. But he knows he's at his limit. He'll have, if he terms out of Washington State, he'll have some corporate, you know, gig. He'll have some board gigs. He's going to be fine, but he won't be getting the sugar high. So he's stuck up on this power web. So he'll insert this into the schools, and Jay Inslee's probably convinced himself this is a good idea. He's probably busily convinced himself of this. But it's the people below Inslee who are driving me crazy. Listen to this Aldous Huxley quote. The surest way to work up a crusade in favor of some good cause is to promise people they will have a chance at maltreating someone, to be able to destroy with a good conscience, to be able to behave badly and call your bad behavior righteous indignation. This is a height of psychological luxury, the most delicious of moral treats. You get to tear down. Tearing down is the easiest act on earth. Building is the hardest. It takes 1 second to end a life. It takes 9 months to build one and then some. Just to build life. Well, to build birth life, I should say, as a birthing person, takes 9 months. I think life begins before that. Think of the effort it took to build a political system that literally existed, where people were governed at the consent of the governed. Think of the effort that took. Think of the study that took. It's 2021, and it's not going to take long to tear this apart. The tearing apart has begun. The tearing asunder has begun. And the convincing people that they're going to be able to maltreat others is happening before our eyes. This is a very elegant way to say what I've been saying in a far less elegant sense, and that is that the left thinks they're building a monster they can control. You ask Jenny Durkin, the so-called mayor of Seattle, how much control she felt when the mob marched up to her house, which is supposed to be secret. You ask the mayor of so-called mayor of Olympia how much control she felt after the domestic terrorists broke into her house and vandalized it, even though she had the Don't Vandalize Me, the Black Lives Matter Incorporated stickers on her house and on her windows. I mean, that was it. Hey, I'm part of the team. They didn't care. They broke in. You ask people in the Senate or in the House how much control they felt on January 6th, where people were breaking into the House of Representatives. Yes, I know that was a lot of Trump supporters and at least one Black Lives Matter Incorporated activist, and I fail to believe he was alone. You ask them how much control they felt there. That was a direct response to another group of people being told, shown, indicated, demonstrated for, that they can maltreat people in good conscience. They can maltreat people to do good things. This is the enablement of a psychological army that is now beginning to take to the streets and beginning to know, not just on freeways, but into residential neighborhoods. I can't warn you any more clearly. When this summer there were people marching through residential neighborhoods saying, fire, fire, gentrifier, or gentrifier, gentrifier, get the fire, get the fire. They're talking about burning people out of their homes. They've been promised they can maltreat others. And guess what? They get to maltreat others. They get to maltreat cops because it's in service of eradicating Nazism. Because all cops are literal Nazis. If you are in the education profession and you refuse, or you're scared or afraid, or you've convinced yourself it's not your role to speak out about Jay Inslee installing racism in the schools, this is now your racism. And listen, I love you. I love you, and I beg you to speak out. I know, I get paid for a living. I get paid to speak for a living. I know, my mom was a teacher. My wife was a teacher. I've worked in the government schools. You want your job, you want to teach your job. Then get together with your friends in private. Get together with your colleagues in private tonight. The majority of people with whom you work do not believe themselves to be racist. And let's just put this to the test. If critical race theory is correct, and the problem with white people, or probably the problem with the world is we're white, and the problem with white people is they're white, and it's all whiteness, that's the problem, then the great news is There's a couple of easy fixes to eradicate racism forever from the world. I'll reveal those to you after we check traffic with Right Way Traffic. It's been entertaining to watch, to say the least, to be getting Epoch, or I'm supposed to say Epoch Times. They need to change the spelling of that great newspaper. To get Epoch Times news alerts, Jay Inslee signs critical race theory into law. Of course he does. To get, I'll be on EIB again today, to get EIB, you know, to get to drive-by callers on EIB. Hey, ask Todd if Jay Inslee's really installed critical race theory. Or to people tweeting me during, you know, Rush's program, talk about critical race theory. I did. I talked about Jay Inslee installing that. People waking up to this, are you shocked? Let's go through the good news about critical race theory. If it's true that the problem with the world is white people or whiteness, and the problem with white people is they're white, well, it's easy to fix. You could kill all the white people, but that's a large-scale project. And that's a big, scary idea. And I don't think there's very many people who think they're signing up for that. I think there's a lot of big, egg-headed academics for whom whiteness is a fun theory, but they're also white. I don't think they understand that this stuff gets out of control. You start teaching a generation of kids that, look, everything's going to be good if you just get rid of the white people. They're going to take you up on that eventually. Now, we're not there yet. We're not there yet. God willing, we'll never get there. Well, let's take it to another step. If the problem with the world is whiteness and the problem with white people is they're white, just don't let them have anything. You could end racism in the government schools tomorrow. Just fire every white teacher. Because, as we know, black people can't be racist. And only white Hispanics can be racist. And Asian people, well, they're teetering on the fence. You may or may not be able to be racist. If you're Asian and gay, you can't be racist. If you're Asian and a Trump supporter, well, then you're morally white. And in that case, you can be racist because your Asianness has been taken over by your moral whitehood. Now you're a white person. Boom. You know, magic. Abracadabra. You now are can't work in polite worlds. Now, that's the logic of this theory. So, again, if you're a teacher, you do understand that the logical extension of critical race theory in the schools is you don't get to be in the schools. You don't get to teach there. It has to be a black person, or it has to be a gay Asian person, or a non-white Mexican, or a non-white Brazilian, or a non-white Cuban, because white Cubans can't do it because they're racist. And if we're going to fool ourselves into believing that there aren't generations of people being brought up with the knowledge that they get to destroy things and maltreat people in pursuit of good, which is this Aldous Huxley quote from Chrome Yellow, then look at this. Let's start with something easy. The Stranger. The Stranger is what I consider to be mental pornography in Seattle. And in fact, in my judgment, their entire business model is based on sex trafficking. You look at the ads in the back of this junk free paper that they hand out. It's all sex trafficking ads, as I see it. That's how I would explain it. They seem to be prostitution related ads to me. Sex trafficking related. Certainly involves things that build a market for sex trafficking, and that makes sense for The Stranger. That's kind of what I consider the so-called paper to be. Here's a headline. Why haven't we funded the blanking street sinks yet? And the blanking is the F word. Why haven't we funded them yet? Oh, okay, I get it. That's not the big revolution I'm talking about here, except it is. From the perspective of The Stranger, we haven't done enough to invite street people to make their homes on the streets. Seattle isn't yet sufficiently overtaken with drug addicts, with heroin addicts and fentanyl addicts. We haven't been sufficiently overrun. So we need street sinks. 30 years ago when the so-called needle exchanges were actually needle exchanges. Where are we at now? They're not needle exchanges anymore. You walk up and you say, I need 60 needles. They'll give you that. They'll also steer you to where you can pick up the heroin, which the taxpayers are going to provide. There is your junk food. This is the people who vote for the Inslees eating, sucking on. I made this example of anorexics. Anorexics have this equation in their mind, taste per calorie. So they have like really sharp tasting foods, like popsicles are big for them because you get a bunch of taste, very little calorie. In this case, the stranger gets a big, big, big dopamine high. Look at this. We want sinks for homeless people. Seattle smug rolls get the same. I'm so caring that I am voting to put sinks on the street so homeless people can wash themselves. Well, they've never seen a drug camp. They've never seen children rescued from a sex trafficking camp. Because they can't be bothered to go look into that. But let's get further down to this. This is beginning to happen in residential neighborhoods in Portland. It's not beginning to happen. I misspoke. Antifa and Black Lives Matter are taking the cold civil war from the city of Portland into the residential neighborhoods. Why? Because they want a visual where a residential liver, someone who they would consider a NIMBY, not in my backyard, shoots a Black Lives Matter incorporated street soldier. That's what they're seeking. That's why they're blocking roads. That's why they're banging drums. That's why they're threatening to burn people out of their houses. And in Portland, they succeeded in pulling a guy out of his car and beating him. He had to go to a trauma center. Victoria Taft, who fills on my program, wrote a piece on PJ Media about this. They did this in Texas, in that case on a freeway. Listen to this. This is a generation of people who've been told you get to maltreat people because you're stopping, you're preventing literal Nazis from running the people. Listen to this from Portland.
Stop the car! Stop that car! Stop the car! You mother! You get the wrong people, bro! Stop the car! Stop the car! Stop the car! Stop the car! Stop the car!
This is, so there's that, and thank you, Alex, for bleeping that. Surrounding people in the streets in residential neighborhoods. Listen to more of this and understand, as you're listening to this, there are police officers there. They're watching this. So as you listen to this and you hear me, please understand, in talking about Inslee forcing critical race theory into the schools, forcing racism into the schools, it's scary to lose your job. It's frightening. It might be catastrophic for your family. I do understand. I beg you to understand me. That behavior, that's coming to your neighborhoods. That's coming to your home. It's coming to your home because the emboldening of groups like that is nonstop. It's coming to your neighborhoods because in your schools, you, if you allow yourself to be used to be forced to teach racism against white people, you will be teaching a generation of children to do that. You never need to speak the words. Go do that. You never need to speak them. Why? Because people are innately good. And when you tell a generation of kids, all white people are murderers, all homes in the suburbs were stolen from people of color, all things that white people have were stolen from people of color, they're going to, as this Huxley quote says, they're going to form a crusade in favor of some good cause and promise that they'll have a chance to maltreat someone. If I can help you in a quest to leave your teaching job or to speak out in your teaching job or to connect you with other teachers like you, I'll do it. If you get fired as a result of speaking out, I will do everything I can on this radio program to help you raise money, to help you find another job. But right now, the way this stands, teachers have two choices. be involved in a system that's pushing racism, literally, or speak out? Well, I guess a third one, leave. We'll come back on the Todd Herman Show on AM 770 KTTH with more on the state's efforts to just control the way people think. It's our continuing buildup into the trial of Dr. Tony Fauci, so-called Dr. Tony Fauci. You're going to hear from a Harvard epidemiologist of 20 years. His name is Dr. Martin Kulldorff. Tony Fauci has pretended the group that Martin Kulldorff helped found, the Great Barrington Declaration, that they're all wrong about everything. Give a listen to Martin Kulldorff as we continue building towards a trial of Tony Fauci. You tell me who was right and who was wrong, Kulldorff or Fauci. We'll come back on the Todd Herman Show. It's my pleasure to chat with Dr. Martin Kulldorff, PhD, professor, Harvard Medicine. Professor, thank you for doing this. Appreciate it so much.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
My listeners wanted me to tell you, and I wanted to tell you, thank you for the Great Barrington Declaration. This is so important in our society. And I wonder if you would share with us how this came together, that such robust, well-respected scientists got together to say, we need to stop the lockdowns.
Well, there are many of us who work with the infectious disease immunology that has been trying to get this message out for a long time, since the spring. We thought that maybe it would be more effective if the three of us came together and did it together, because it's easier to dismiss a single person than to dismiss three people.
Yeah. I've studied COVID-19, the coronavirus, now for 32 hours a week for 7 months, and I can never get to your academic level, obviously. But one thing I know is media, and I was so upset today to see CNN, and I do the radio show for Seattle, calling you guys maverick scientists. And it's my understanding that the lockdown itself is a departure from science, or the best practices in science. Is that correct?
Yeah, so lockdown is it's a terrible experiment, I think. If we go back before the pandemic, what we are proposing is what was in all the pandemic preparedness plans that different countries had prepared. And I haven't done a formal survey, but among my colleagues that I talk to that are infectious disease epidemiologists, the majority, not 100%, but the majority are in favor of this focused protection that we are proposing. So I don't see it as something maverick at all. More like stating what's established public health practice.
Yeah. I am equally disturbed, Dr. Kulldorff. Do you like to be professor or doctor when you're interviewed? You have so many titles, I'll have to choose one, I guess, but which you prefer?
I like when people call me by my first name, Martin.
All right, I'll do that. Thank you, Martin. That's very gracious of you. That I have seen the media, members of the media, news programmers, and in fact, President Obama's former Surgeon General, rebranding herd immunity as he called it herd mentality. I listened this morning to the gentleman who runs the World Health Organization saying that herd immunity can only be achieved, Martin, by keeping people away from the virus. And this runs counter to my understanding. And I think herd immunity is important to what you're doing in this focused care of caring for the most vulnerable. So let's talk about those range of issues. Is herd immunity some weird theory?
No, it's sort of stunning as a scientist to see people talk about herd immunity in this way, because herd immunity is a well-established scientific fact, a phenomena that we know exists for infectious diseases, and every epidemiologist will acknowledge that it does exist. So it's like gravity. It's a fact in physics.
Yeah.
And to talk about herd immunity strategy doesn't make sense, because whatever strategy we use for COVID-19, we will eventually end up with herd immunity sooner or later. So it's like two airplane pilots sitting up in the airplane, up in the air, discussing, well, should we use the gravity strategy to land the plane or not? It doesn't make any sense. The plane is going to get down to the ground sooner or later, no matter what they do. But the purpose is to land the plane with as few casualties as possible. And with COVID-19, the purpose is that we need to get through this pandemic with as few deaths as possible. That's the purpose.
Yeah.
We might minimize the death, and that's why we propose this focused protection, because that's what will minimize the mortality.
And the focus protection, let's talk about that. That is focusing on people who are truly at risk. And my understanding, Martin, is that these are people at least above the age of 70 with, it's my understanding that people who pass away with or from this virus have three comorbid factors very commonly. Are these the people that you focus on and that the Barrington Declaration calls on to provide the most focused care and protection to?
They are included, but it's broader than that. We all know that COVID-19 is riskier for the older. Now, everybody can be infected, so it's not a difference in the risk of being infected. That's fairly equal, I think, across the ages, and no big differences. So the difference in risk is in mortality or dying from it. And it's not just a twofold or a fourfold or a tenfold. It's not even a hundredfold difference in risk. The difference in risk between the oldest and the youngest is more than a thousandfold. There's an enormous difference in risk for mortality. And among older people, COVID-19 is more serious than an annual influenza. Every year, a lot of old people die from the influenza, but COVID-19 is worse than that, much more worse. On the other hand, for children, every year about 200 to 1,000 children in the U.S. die from the influenza, depending on if it's a bad influenza season or not. But that's more than for COVID-19. So for children, COVID-19 is less risky and a milder disease. Yeah. So that's what we have to utilize. And of course, those in the 70s and 80s are at higher risk. At the highest risk, and if you have comorbidities, if you're frail, it's even worse. But also people in the 60s are fairly high risk, while people below 50 are at low risk.
I want to bridge back over to my area of expertise. One of them is media. And Martin, you and your colleagues, I want to make sure that we talk about your colleagues who helped found and create the Barrington Declaration. I've heard Professor Gupta explain that she can't get papers published that discuss T-cell immunity and crossover immunity. That's chilling to me. And I heard you say that as well-respected as you three of you are in the world of epidemiology, that you couldn't get a witness in the media to get your word out. This is not an epidemiological question. This is a societal question. I find this chilling, Martin, and worrying. Are you guys surprised that you couldn't get witness and surprised that Professor Gupta's had problems getting papers published all of a sudden?
I think it's stunning because the three of us, we all come from reasonably respectable universities, I think.
Yes.
And back in the spring, I tried to publish these thoughts, and I had no success in the American media, whether the lay sort of the regular layperson media, nor in the scientific media. I'm a native of Sweden, and in Sweden I had no problems publishing, so I published three op-eds in the major daily newspapers there, so that wasn't a problem. But in the U.S., it turned out to be impossible for me. Until about a month ago, things started to change.
Yeah. And I'm very thankful. I've seen your piece in Spiked, which is a very important publication, LinkedIn piece you wrote, The Spectator, all excellent pieces. I'm of the position with my audience, Martin, that the word cases is an empty scare word. And I liken it this way. If I were to say that there have been 200,000 mechanical incidents with the 737 airplane this month, you probably wouldn't fly one. And if I said, but 90, and you'll get the number I'm using here, 99.73 or 87% of these were the toilets, the speakers in the stereos, that didn't involve anything safety oriented, you would reconsider. In what does a case mean? I mean, what is a case?
That's a great analogy. It used to be that a case was somebody who was sick. And if you are sick of COVID-19 and you have to go to the hospital, then you're a case. But defining cases as somebody who is asymptomatic and has a positive PCR test doesn't make any sense for me. And I've talked to physician colleagues, and it doesn't make sense to them.
It makes sense to me from a perspective of media. It's a big number. And it's an impressive number. And I wanted to talk to you about this asymptomatic phenomenon with the PCR cycles. You had mentioned the thousandfold order of magnitude difference between young people and older people in relation to the fatality rate of this disease, the COVID. And the PCR cycle testing, I'm at a loss as to understand how the 40-cycle PCR test is viable. It's my understanding that you are magnifying the genetic material, Martin. Is it correct to say, someone told me, a trillion times so that you can find a shred of incomplete genetic material? Is that true?
So it's interesting how the cycle times of PCR test is now common knowledge in this world, which it wasn't a year ago. But if with any test, there will be false positives and false negatives. So if you mass test college students that are asymptomatic, you're going to have some false positives for whatever reasons. And you're basically going to isolate the quarantine a lot of students who are not sick and who are not pose risk to others. So in my view, there's no public health reason at all to do testing among college students or school children unless they are so sick that they go to the hospital. Then you have to test them because you have to know what treatment you're going to give them. Do they have COVID-19 or not? But to test just asymptomatic or mildly symptomatic, there's no public health reason to do that. There is reason to test the nursing home staff, for example, because you don't want this to get into the nursing homes. So unless the nursing home staff is already immune, you want to do frequent testing of them. You also want to test visitors to nursing home because they're not only risking the life of the loved ones, but also other people in the nursing home.
Yeah.
So their testing is very important. And to me, there is better to be more safe than sorry. So a false positive is not a huge issue because it means they have to visit their grandmother 3 weeks later. On the other hand, a false negative could have dire consequences. So in that setting, you have to be sort of have a threshold that makes you more safe than sorry. But then to use that same threshold for school kids is nonsensical. And I don't think you should test school children at all. If a child is sick, they have a cough or running nose, let them stay home. Doesn't matter if it's COVID-19 or not. If they're asymptomatic, they should be in school and learn what they need to learn.
Is it a correct understanding, and Martin Koldorf's with us, PhD professor, Harvard Medical School, as he said, a reasonably well-respected medical school, as are your colleagues, Oxford, et cetera. Professor, is it a fair thing to say that if young people get back on with their lives, we're not just helping society, because I want to talk about the lives lost, I think, due to the lockdown, but are we also not reducing the places that the virus can live? Isn't that one of the roles of herd immunity and younger people, that we take away places the virus can live in sort of as it lies in wait for an older person or a sicker person?
Yeah, so there are two problems with the lockdown. One is all the collateral damage. And there's collateral damage for public health, worse cardiovascular disease outcomes, plummeting vaccination rates. Cancers are not detected. So somebody who would have lived for maybe 15, 20 years will maybe die now in 3 to 4 years. So we won't see that in the mortality statistics this year, but this is something we're going to have to live with for a long time. A big problem is the mental health issues, both for the young and the old. So there's all that collateral damage. But even if you put that aside and we only look at COVID-19, What the lockdowns, what it does is it pushes things in the forward. So if you're an old person, 74 years old, say, you have to be very careful and take precautions and not mingle with people too much. But if we do the lockdown, we're pushing things in the future. So the amount of time that the older people have to do this, protect themselves, is going to be long. It's going to be over a year now, and it could be even more than that. And the longer time they have to self-isolate, the more difficult it is, both in terms of their own social life and mental health being, but also just protecting them from COVID-19, because at some point they're going to have to go to the doctor or the dentist. So the longer we drag it out, the more difficult it is to protect the elderly, high-risk people in the population.
Yeah.
So by young people protecting themselves from the disease, they're making a disservice by doing so.
Fascinating. And Doctor, I've read an analysis from you and I have a friend in common, Dr. Martin Koldos with us, Harvard University, the Barrington Declaration, one of the founders there, one of the three founders. We have some friends in common who are independent data analysts, Justin Hart with Rational Grounds. I had met one of your colleagues, Dr. Atlas, in March of this year. And then I work with a gentleman, he goes on Twitter by the title of Ethical Skeptic. I know who he is. He's a naval intelligence officer, independent data analyst. And it's really fun because he does this data analyst, doctor. And then Martin, he opens this up for peer review. Right, here's my source material. Here's my mathematical assumptions. He contends that we are going to see a hundredfold loss of life years from the lockdown. Life years, you mentioned the younger people may die sooner. He has also analyzed that he feels like right now that we may be losing more people from the lockdown than from COVID itself. Does that sound out of proportion to you, or what are your observations as where we sit today with that loss of life?
I think it's huge and terrifying with the negative consequences of the lockdown, the collateral damage. Some of it is sort of already occurring, but a lot of it is going to have long-term consequences. So we won't see it in the mortality statistics until later on.
Yeah.
So, and how to quantify it is, of course, difficult. We can quantify maybe... It's even difficult to quantify as the effect on cancer, for example, but to do it across all health aspects is very difficult. But for sure, it's tragic and scary. Yeah. And the longer the lockdown continues, the worse it's going to be. And you mentioned, for example, Scott Atlas, who I have met. And what we're saying in the Great Barrington Declaration is nothing novel or new. These are things that many of us have said for a long time, including Dr. Atlas since the spring. So he is one other person who has been trying to get this message out. And I was very excited when he was hired to join the White House to sort of help there from the inside. So that was a very positive development in my view.
I have this observation as we close out. You've been so kind with your time. This is where I find myself deeply concerned as someone who has taken a deep dive in learning this tiny little bit of what you know in your profession. And I wish I knew I could have like studied epidemiology. It is absolutely fascinating.
It is.
B, I'm glad that people are studying it. I'm so thankful for the Barrington Declaration. I do a bit of pattern recognition. I'm very concerned because I really observed that there was sort of pre-COVID-19 science, which was evidentiary based and based on observable, testable, measurable, falsifiable. And then I feel like post-COVID-19, there's been a departure from this, that I'd seen the World Health Organization caution against lockdowns in the case of a SARS-type respiratory viruses. Dr. Fauci had cautioned against, or members of his team had. I feel like all of a sudden there was this departure from scientific rigor. Is that a layman's misunderstanding, or do you think that happened?
No.
Okay.
It's not a misunderstanding. Right now, the priority is to deal with this pandemic. That's what we have to do now. But once we have, we're going to have to deal with reduced public trust in the scientific community. And I think it's stunning how it has played out, that the scientific discourse has been sort of silenced. And it's something that the scientific community is going to have to deal with once this is over. And it will be interesting to see how it's dealt with. But certainly it's an issue going forward. I still believe fully in science. I think that's the foundation of our civilization since hundreds of years. But my trust in the scientific community has taken a hit for sure.
Okay, I did think of one more question because of what you said, because this just it hit me very hard emotionally to sense in you also that you've observed the same thing, and that you have been silenced, and that your colleagues have been silenced. That shouldn't happen. And I pictured Bill Gates. I used to work for Bill. I mean, several steps removed, but I used to work at Microsoft, and I've met him. He gets on any TV he wants. Columbia Journalism Review wrote about him purchasing positive coverage. What's it like for you as a recognized expert, or your colleagues recognized experts, to not be able to get on TV? How do you feel when you watch Bill Gates saying the world can't go back to normal until the second round of vaccines?
It was stunning to observe media saying that there is scientific for consensus for something that I did not agree with. And me feeling that I knew a lot, having worked with infectious disease outbreaks for a couple of decades, and it didn't make sense to me. I didn't agree with it. So that was sort of a stunning experience. And then when I tried to humbly say that what I thought, it wasn't interesting to hear what I had to say. But that has changed now. So I'm very, very appreciative of that. And there has, from the beginning, been certain media outlets that have been more open-minded. And I think they deserve a lot of credit for that.
Yeah. I am so thankful for the Barrington Declaration. We're going to link to it. We'll make sure we get as many professionals and lay people signing it as possible. Professor, I thank you for what you're doing. Thank you for speaking out. And thank you for restoring my trust in scientists. Thank you for that.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been delightful to talk with you.
You too.